Okay, thanks very much, Louis. It's a pleasure to be here. In fact, by way of introduction, I might say I've got a very similar background to David Olson. I teach at the Rotman School here, so I'm business background, but I also did a math. My original training was in math. I did my undergraduate work at Cambridge University in England. You can probably tell by my accent that I wasn't born and bred in Canada. One of the things about Cambridge, which is kind of interesting, is that everybody does the same set of math courses in the first 2 years, and then in third year you get to choose whether you do pure or applied math. And I chose pure math, because anybody who was serious about math at that time seems to choose pure math. If I had chosen applied math, it would have been a lot more useful, given everything that I've done since then. But that's the way it goes sometimes. Anyway, I'm talking today about CVA and wrong-way risk. This is some joint research with my longtime colleague, Alan White, who's also at the Rotman School. Alan and I have been working together for about 25 years now. It's one of those joint research relationships that works really well. Now, and this is a relatively recent paper. What I'm going to talk about, and I realize some of you here probably don't know a whole lot about what I mean when I say CVA or wrong-way risk, so I'll try and make that clear as I go along. But I'm going to talk about the calculation of this thing called CVA, the Basel III requirements. These are the new regulatory requirements for banks. And then a simple model of wrong-way or right-way risk, which Alan and I have come up with, and present some numerical results for that model. I always feel the purpose of these presentations is to convince you to dig up the paper and read it. So if you want to do that after my presentation, you can find it on my website. So what is CVA? Imagine a dealer, large dealer, trades derivatives, has lots of different counterparties that it trades derivatives with. There is the chance that some of those counterparties will default before the derivatives contracts expire. And that default could, in fact, lead to losses by the derivatives dealer. So what CVA is designed to do is to calculate the present value of the expected losses on your derivatives portfolio with each of your counterparties. So you have one CVA for each of your counterparties. Okay, and it's, as I say, it's the expected default losses given the credit quality of the counterparty and that sort of thing. Now, for those of you who are interested in really taxing mathematical problems, CVAs are interesting things to learn about because the CVAs themselves, as we'll see, are derivatives. They can be regarded as derivatives. This expected loss that you have with each of your derivatives counterparties changes through time. You know, the market variables that underlie the derivatives that you have with those counterparties move up and down. The credit spreads of the counterparties move up and down. And so your CVA moves around through time. So your CVA with that counterparty is a derivative. And in fact, it's a much more complicated derivative than any of the regular derivatives that you've negotiated with that counterparty. By definition, as you'll see, it is much more complicated. So if you're looking for challenging problems, where difficult things to value, looking into CVAs is something you might want to do. Now, we're concerned with transactions that are cleared bilaterally. So we're concerned with the situation where a dealer negotiates a transaction with one of its counterparties. It could be another dealer, it could be a corporate counterparty, it could be a fund manager. And basically they sign an agreement. Usually the agreement, there's an agreement they sign which is called the ISDA, International Swaps and Derivatives Association Master Agreement, that will cover all the derivative transactions they've entered into with each other. And then they, what we call, clear them bilaterally. I'm not talking about central clearing, which is something that is becoming a much bigger part of the over-the-counter derivatives market as a result of legislation in all the major countries in point of fact. Right now, roughly 25% of over-the-counter derivatives are cleared centrally. It's estimated that this will go up to 75% as a result of the legislation that's out there. Most standard over-the-counter derivatives will be cleared centrally. However, the more complicated non-standard derivatives will still be cleared bilaterally and will give rise to the sort of problems that I talk about in this paper. If you're interested in central clearing, I've also written papers on central clearings, which you'll find on my website, but that's not what we're talking about here. Transactions are netted. This is one of the things in the ISDA master agreement, which basically means that all the transactions you have with a counterparty are considered as a single transaction in the event that the counterparty fails to perform. So if the counterparty doesn't live up to its obligations on one or more of the derivatives contracts that you have with the counterparty, then all the derivatives contracts that you have with that counterparty are considered as one. And that actually reduces the derivative dealer's credit exposure, because derivatives with positive value are netted off against derivatives with negative value. Often there's a collateralization agreement, which is called a CSA, which is an annex to the ISDA master agreement. The CSA is Credit Support Annex, which describes the collateral that has to be posted between the two parties. So it might be a one-way CSA or a two-way CSA. So it might be that the counterparty, it's only the counterparty that's required to post collateral, or it might be that both the financial institution and the counterparty are required to post collateral. Failure to post collateral is the most common reason for derivative transactions to be wound up. And failure to post collateral as required gives the dealer the right to terminate transactions. Okay, that's important for what we're going to be talking about. Or it might well be, of course, the dealer fails to post collateral, in which case the other side has the right to terminate transactions. Okay, I mean, there are other events that give one or both parties the right to terminate transactions, but the one that we're going to be most concerned with here and the one that's most common is failure to post collateral. Okay, here's some definitions that are part of the CSA, Credit Support Annex. The threshold is the unsecured credit exposure to the counterparty that the dealer is prepared to bear. I'm going to talk about the dealer's exposure to the counterparty. It works the same the other way around. But for example, if the threshold is 10 million, what that means is that we value the transactions we have between each other every day. And if I'm the dealer and you're the counterparty, and we find that the value of the transactions to me is 7 million, shall we say, we haven't yet reached the threshold, which is 10 million, so no collateral is required. It's only when the value of the transactions to me exceeds 10 million that I require collateral from you. And you'll have to post that collateral daily. So if the value of the transactions becomes, shall we say, 15 million, then I would require 5 million of collateral from you. Okay? So the threshold is kind of like a line of credit, which I as the dealer offer you as the counterparty in the derivatives transactions we're entering into. Independent amount is an initial margin that must be maintained by the counterparty in addition to the dealer's exposure. So it's an amount that I'm going to require from you as collateral regardless of the value of transactions. And it's like an initial margin in futures transactions. Independent amounts are relatively rare in the over-the-counter market. And this is one of the big differences between bilateral clearing and central clearing. because when derivatives are moved from bilateral clearing to central clearing, in fact, there will always be an initial margin, which is what's called an independent amount here. But although albeit the documentation gives you the possibility of ticking that box as far as the independent amount is concerned, it rarely is ticked. So the independent amount is kind of like a negative threshold. Okay, I mean, if I require 5 million independent amount from you, that means regardless of the value of the transactions, you've got to post 5 million of collateral with me. Okay, so it's kind of like a negative threshold. The cure period, which is going to figure fairly prominently in what we talk about, is the period that is assumed to elapse between the counterparty failing to post collateral or failing to perform in some other way, but most likely failing to post collateral, and an early termination notice. So what happens is, you know, every day you revalue the transactions and you write to the counterparty and say, well, I need another 2 million of collateral from you because the transactions have moved in my favor by 2 million. And most of the time, the counterparty will just post the 2 million with you. Sometimes the counterparty will argue about the valuation of the transactions, and that will take a little while to be sorted out. Sometimes the counterparty is experiencing genuine financial difficulties, in which case it's going to think of all sorts of reasons why it shouldn't post the collateral. So it takes some time for that process to work its way through. I mean, the ISDA contract will say, you know, I can issue an early termination notice within 2 days of you failing to post collateral, but that never happens in practice, because in practice there's all sorts of backwards and forwards about, you know, the value of the transactions and so on. So typically dealers assume 10 to 15 days as the cure period, what's called the cure period, which is the time that elapses between collateral not being posted and an early termination notice, which basically means the deals are being wound up. Typically you're talking about 10 to 15 days. And this is important because, I mean, let's suppose we had zero threshold. Zero threshold means that the deals are fully collateralized. Okay, well, as soon as the deal moves in my favor, I request collateral from you, you pay me collateral, moves more in my favor, you pay me more collateral. But if there were a zero cure period, then I would have zero credit exposure, because I've always got enough collateral to protect myself when the early termination notice is put. But in practice, it's that 15 days that's going to elapse between you not posting collateral and me being able to issue an early termination notice, because the disputes resolution procedure has worked its way through and so on, that creates the exposure. So zero threshold doesn't mean zero credit exposure. It means you've got this 15-day or whatever you decide is the correct length of time of exposure. Okay, I don't usually include a lot of math in my presentations, but I thought with this group I would. This is an expression for CVA. What's it saying? It's saying, well, we've got all these derivatives that are outstanding with the counterparty, and the final maturity date for the longest derivative, you know, is capital T, so that might be, you know, 25 years or something like that, the longest derivative that we have with the counterparty. And so we're integrating something between today and the time of the longest derivative. And we've got the QT times VT. Now, QT is the risk-neutral probability density function of the time to default. If you consider QT delta T is the probability of defaulting between time T and time T plus delta T. The unconditional, it's not a hazard rate, it's the unconditional probability of defaulting between time T and time T plus delta T. And then, so that's the probability that there will be a default, which means collateral will, this early termination notice will be served. And then we've got to multiply that by, if that happens, what will be the exposure? And of course, it's not the exposure at that time, it's the present value of the exposure, and that's what VT is. So VT is the present value of the exposure at that time. So we want to take the probability multiplied by the present value of the exposure and, you know, integrate. And then, of course, you don't necessarily lose everything when the counterparty fails to perform. There'll be some recovery. And so what you lose is 1 minus the recovery rate times what you get when you integrate this thing. So that's the equation that we're basically working with as far as calculating CBA is concerned. Now, if there's no collateralization at all, no CSA, then the exposure that you have at a particular time is just the maximum of the value of the derivatives to you and zero. So WT here is the value of the derivatives at time T that you have with the counterparty. So you sort of add up all the values of the derivatives. I should say you add up the value of all the derivatives that you have with the counterparty, netting off positive values with negative values, and that's what WT is. And if that's positive, then you have an exposure, because if the counterparty disappears, you may lose that positive value. If it's a negative value, you don't have an exposure. So you can see that if we just take the exposure with no collateralization, what you have is an option-like function, kind of like a call option, on the total value of the derivatives that you have with that counterparty, which is the WT. So that's, you know, that's a simple situation where there's no collateral posted. When there's a threshold of K and the cure period is C, the collateral available at time T is given by that middle expression there, because if there's a default or an early termination notice because of problems at time T, then the counterparty stopped posting collateral C days or time C ago. Okay, so the last collateral that was posted was at time T minus C. So what you have as collateral is the value of the derivatives outstanding with the counterparty at time T minus C. And then, of course, you've got to subtract the threshold, if there is a threshold, and take the maximum of that in zero. So that's the collateral that, you know, that you have to offset your exposure. So your net exposure is the exposure with no collateral minus the collateral that's available, if any, which is that expression at the bottom. And just to go back, the VT here is the is actually just the present value of this net exposure. Okay. So, of course, to calculate that integral, which is, you know, the CBA expression, we have to discretize, and so, you know, we divide the time between now and this future time horizon into a lot of steps, and we calculate so we have a lot of intervals, and we calculate the probability of a default within each interval, which would just indicate how that's done in a moment. So that's what we're calling Q sub I, which is the unconditional probability of a default between times Ti minus 1 and Ti. And then Vi is the exposure at the midpoint of the interval. So basically, we we sort of fairly standard way of discretizing that integral we have to calculate to get CVA. Estimating QI. QI is this probability of default within an interval. We do this from credit spreads, and it turns out that there's a pretty easy expression for the hazard rate, for the average hazard rate in terms of credit spreads, which is given here. So that if SI is the credit spread for a maturity of TI, then the average hazard rate, which of course is a conditional, not an unconditional default probability, the average hazard rate up to time TI is SI divided by 1 minus R, and an estimate of QI is, using standard maths associated with hazard rates is given by that expression there. And in fact, you'll find that expression in the Basel III documents as well. Okay. So now this expression SI divided by 1 minus R is sufficiently accurate, not 100% accurate, sufficiently accurate that it can be used for most purposes. So what do we do? In practice, to calculate CVA, we have to resort to Monte Carlo simulation, and it's a huge task. It involves a huge amount of computing horsepower, lots of parallel processors and that sort of thing. What you do, because remember, you're doing this for each of your counterparties, so you may have, well, let me just give you a for instance. When Lehman went bankrupt, it had 8,000 different derivatives counterparties. 8,000. So Lehman, which is not the biggest derivatives dealer in the world, Lehman would have to calculate 8,000 different CVAs. So you'd be doing what I'm talking about now 8,000 times. So what do you do? You look at, say I've got all these derivatives outstanding with this counterparty. What are the market variables that underlie those derivatives? You simulate the behavior of those market variables, maybe 10,000, 100,000 times, something like that, and calculate the value of the portfolio that you currently have with the counterparty at, well, you've got all these intervals that you're using to discretize, intervals you're using to discretize the integral. So TI star is the midpoint of each of the intervals, so you calculate the value of the derivatives portfolio at the midpoint of each interval, and then of course, you also have to calculate it at C date, at a time period C before the midpoint of the interval, because you want to know how much collateral you would have if the counterparty defaulted at that time. So, what you find in practice when you do this is your Monte Carlo simulation has got unequal time steps because you're interested in these two types of dates. So this is a big exercise, as you can imagine, because you're talking about valuing a whole portfolio many times as you do this Monte Carlo simulation, because you might have 50 different TI stars, for example, which would mean you have 100 different points at which you're valuing the portfolio for each simulation trial for each counterparty. And one of the challenges here, which has received a lot of attention, is to say, well, what approximations can we make to actually make this computationally feasible? Because, let's suppose I have a derivatives transaction with you, and the normal way I value this transaction is Monte Carlo simulation. But because it's a fairly complicated transaction, I can't really do it that way here, because I would then have a Monte Carlo simulation within a Monte Carlo simulation, which, as we all know, gets pretty hairy. I've typically got to simplify matters quite a bit. So the valuation models that are used within the CVA analysis tend to be simpler than the valuation models that are used. Well, there's two, actually, when you get into this, there's two value. There's the valuation model you use for your regular mark-to-market calculations, valuing the deals every day, and there's also, it turns out, the models you use to simulate the market variables within the Monte Carlo simulation. Both of those are typically more complicated than the actual valuation procedure. Another little wrinkle of all of this is that when you do the Monte Carlo simulation, for all your counterparties, say 8,000 different counterparties, maybe 100,000 different Monte Carlo trials, valuing at maybe 100 different points, you remember everything. You store everything. Because what might happen is the trader on the floor says, I'd like to, between two of these calculations, the trader on the floor might say, well, I want to do another deal with this counterparty. And what would be the incremental effect on the CVA of a new deal with this counterparty? And obviously you don't want to have to completely do the CVA calculation all over again. So by remembering all that data, you can all you have to then simulate is this one new transaction with the counterparty. You don't have to simulate all the transactions you have with the counterparty. How many transactions do you typically have with a counterparty? Well, going back to Lehman had about 1.5 million transactions with 8,000 different counterparties. So you can work out that several hundred transactions on average with each counterparty. Okay, so that's CVA. We're going to come back to, I haven't really got on to the main thing I want to talk about yet, but this is all by way of introduction. DVA is kind of something that's a little bit more controversial than CVA, but now well established. A lot of people don't agree with DVA. So CVA is saying, you're my counterparty, you may default, I'm going to reduce the value of my transactions with you to reflect the possibility that you will default. Basically you have a derivative, which is your option to default, which I have to value. DVA is the fact that I might default, debit value adjustment, sometimes called debt value adjustment. So as a dealer, I might default, and that actually increases the value of the, in theory anyway, increases the value of the transactions I have with you, because presumably, when I default, it's a benefit, it could be a benefit to my shareholders because I get out of some transactions which have a negative value to me. So the way the accounting rules work now, and a lot of people don't agree with this, but the way the accounting rules work right now is that what dealers do is calculate a no-default value for the derivatives with the counterparty. They subtract the CVA and then add the DVA. Actually, it's even more complicated than that, because there's some interactions between the CVA and the DVA, because if I'm doing transactions with you, if I'm going to lose money, you've got to default before I default. Okay, so the sequence in which people default actually makes a difference. But that's a very second order effect. So it's reasonable to assume that that expression at the bottom there applies. The real problem with DVA is that the only way I can actually realize that DVA that I have is by defaulting. There's no way I can monetize it otherwise. And so whether it is a real benefit to me or not is debatable. A couple of other things, I was reading the Financial Times earlier this week, and a lot of the banks in the U.S. have recently published their quarterly results, and if I read, some of these articles are not always clear, but if I understood what the articles were saying correctly, the headline was fairy tale accounting. Four-fifths of the profits of major U.S. banks is DVA in the most recent quarter, 4/5. In other words, what's happened is the credit spreads, the credit spreads of these banks has increased in the most recent quarter. And as a result of that, the QIs associated with those banks have gone up. So it looks as though the banks are more likely to default, and more likely to default, okay, these derivative transactions you have are worth more to you because you're more likely to default. So as, you know, this was worth about $3 billion to Citigroup during the crisis in 2008. This, you know, it added $3 billion to Citigroup's bottom line, $1 billion. Because, as I say, Citigroup's credit spreads went up sharply, which means its option to default was worth more. So it's a very strange accounting rule, but it's well established now. And but one thing is, you know, you probably read about the Basel III capital requirements. What we're talking about here, DVA, is not considered to be equity capital as far as Basel III is concerned. So you've heard about how, you know, equity capital has to be 7% of risk-weighted assets, and then there's this, and then there's this. Well, the way in which equity capital is calculated is it's been tightened up quite a bit, and increases in equity capital arising from DVA are not included, not surprisingly. Anyway, it's a bit of an aside. So we're going to focus on CVA, although if you're really interested in DVA, everything I say about CVA, you know, you can sort of stand on your head and say the same thing applies to DVA. The CVA that I have with you, if you're one of my derivatives counterparties, is a complex derivative. Okay? It depends, as I said earlier, it depends on ups and downs in the values of all the market variables that underlie the derivatives that I have with you, because as they move up and down, so my exposure to you moves up and down. And it depends on ups and downs in your credit spreads. In your credit spread. One of the sort of developments in the last few years has been that dealers have been recognizing that the CVA is really no different from any other derivative in their portfolio, and it should be managed in exactly the same way as other derivatives. So, you know, you say, well, not only do I have all the derivatives that I have outstanding with the counterparty, but on top of that, I have the CVA for that counterparty, which is itself a derivative. So when you think, well, how am I going to manage the risk in this derivative? There's actually two types of risk. There's the risk from the QI and there's the risk from the VI. The risk from the QI is associated with changes in the credit spread of the counterparty. So if your credit spread goes up, it means you're more likely to default, and so my CVA will go up. The QI. The VI, which is the exposure, is associated with the market variables that underlie the deal. So you can sort of distinguish the two sorts of risk there. You know, throwing this slide in just to indicate how complicated all of this is, I'm going to show you some results later. And these were actually some results for portfolios that I generated for calculating CVA in various situations. But these were the profiles in the first four simulation trials. These were the profiles of the expected exposures on the portfolios that I was looking at. So you can see how, you know, there's nothing very regular about how the expected exposure moves around through time, because it's being influenced by changes in the market variables and changes in credit spreads, and, you know, some derivatives drop off. The you may have, you know, a two-year derivative that drops off after 2 years and all this sort of thing. So very okay, that's a bit of an aside. So following on from the, you know, two slides ago here, these two sources of risk, the changes in counterparty credit spreads and the changes in the market variables underlying the portfolio, what Basel III, which is this new regulatory requirement for banks says is that banks have to take the CVA risk arising from a parallel shift in the counterparty's term structure of credit spreads into account in calculating its capital for market risk. So in other words, that what they're saying is, yeah, we agree. This CVA that you have, it's just like any other derivative. And right now, we require you to keep capital for the market risk in your derivatives portfolio. This is another source of market risk, which is the credit spread. So, you know, just add that to what you're doing when you calculate market risk. And that, as we're going to see in a minute, is fairly easy to do. What they do not require banks to do, and in fact explicitly don't want banks to do, is to include CVA risk arising from the underlying market variables. So in other words, the QI risk, yeah, take that into account, but the VI risk, don't take that into account. Now, one reason is it's very difficult to calculate the impact on your total risk of the VI. So it's largely a computational issue that a lot of banks just aren't up to doing that. Some banks are already doing it. So some banks have pretty sophisticated procedures for calculating the impact of both the QI and the VI on their market risk, calculating Greek letters and all that sort of thing. Those banks have been complaining quite vociferously about what Basel III is saying, because if in fact they hedge the second sort of risk, the risks arising from the underlying market variables, the hedging instruments they use will increase their market risk, but they don't get any benefit from the market risk that those hedging instruments are offsetting. So if they're really, in other words, they're being penalized for being sophisticated, because they are actually able to hedge the risk arising from the market variables, their capital is actually going up, because they're told to keep extra capital for the markets, for the hedging instruments, but not for the things those hedging instruments are trying to hedge. So here's a little bit of math, which I'm not going to spend time on, but I mean, basically we have our expression for CVA at the top, which is this discretization of the integral, and this is, and then the expression for the QI, which I had on an earlier slide, and you can just use a Taylor series expansion to, and this is actually in Basel III, this Taylor series expansion. Basel III has a really nice way of typesetting all the math, so it's very difficult to read, but or not nice way of typesetting the math, I should say. But basically, that's the expression that's in Basel III, and it follows directly from those two equations above when you do a Taylor series expansion. So that's what banks are expected to do in terms of considering a parallel shift in the term structure. Okay. So that's, in a sense, that's all by way of background. I guess I've got another 20 minutes to talk about what this research that Alan and I have been doing in this field is, which is to do with this thing called wrong way or right way risk, which I would introduce as follows, that we have this expression, and we go back to the integral expression that I started with for CVA, 1 minus r times the integral of the qt and the vt. Now, the assumption that's usually made, just because it's very complicated to make any other assumption, is that the probability of default is independent of the exposure. In other words, the qt and the vt are independent of each other. So if the counterparty, if I have a lot of exposure to the counterparty, in other words, my derivatives that I have outstanding with the counterparty are very valuable, to me, the counterparty is no more likely to default than if it's the other way around. Now, obviously, you can think of all sorts of arguments why that might or might not be true. Wrong way risk occurs when QT is positively dependent on DT. So in other words, you're more likely to default when I have a big exposure to you, and less likely to default when I have a small exposure to you. Now remember, I'm not your only counterparty, you've got all sorts of other counterparties, so you may well not be defaulting because of problems, or not be running into financial difficulties because of the transactions you have with me. You know, there's all sorts of other things going on in your universe which are unrelated. So it's not necessarily the case that we have wrong way risk. I mean, if I was your only counterparty, and you know, your derivatives with me were a really huge part of your business, yeah, then for sure there'd be wrong way risk. But you know, typically I'm just a little fish in your great big pond as far as the transactions you have with me are concerned. Right way risk occurs when it's the other way around, that QT is negatively dependent on VT. So let's look at some examples. Wrong way risk typically occurs if the counterparty is selling credit protection. So if I buy credit protection from you, so typically it could be something called a credit default swap, where you are selling me protection against somebody else defaulting. Okay, then there's a problem, because if I buy credit protection from you against you defaulting, and the contract has become, you know, that contract starts to have a positive value to me, the reason it'll have a positive value to me will be because of the credit spread of the entity that you're providing protection against has gone up. In other words, that company has become more dodgy. And the chances are that if that credit spread has gone up, your credit spread has gone up as well, because credit spreads tend to be correlated, in which case, you know, we have wrong way risk, because the Q and the V are correlated. If the counterpart is a hedge fund that's taking big speculative positions, that's also going to be a problem, because, you know, our derivatives with the hedge fund are part of the speculative positions, and if the speculative positions don't work out, then, you know, then we will have the speculative positions will have a negative value to the hedge fund and a positive value to us. We will have a big exposure, and you know, the hedge fund obviously becomes more likely to default, because that's a big part of what it's doing. Right way risk is, you know, in the opposite sort of situation. If the counterparty is buying credit protection, that should give right way risk. And if the counterparty is partially hedging a major exposure, when you work that one through, that should normally be right way risk as well, because the counterparty should benefit. If the derivatives start to have a positive value to me, then the exposure is is working out in the counterparty's favor, and the unhedged bit will benefit the counterparty. But there's a lot of problems in estimating wrong way, right way risk, which in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over this slide. Allowing for wrong way risk, the most common approach is to use the alpha multiplier, as it's called, to increase the V's. So the most common approach is just to say, well, we'll do this calculation on the assumption of independence, and then we will just scale everything up. And Basel II, which says that you should scale everything up by 40%, or if you have your own internal model to calculate wrong way risk, then you can use your internal model, but we still require you to scale things up by at least 20%. Okay, so there's now we're getting on to the model that underlies this paper, and you know, there has been some academic research on modeling wrong way and right way risk, and by and large, the models that have been suggested are pretty complicated. The most common model is something called the exposure sampling model, which kind of assumes some sort of that the exposure that you have with the counterparty follows some sort of one-factor model, and so on and so on. What Alan and I tend to do in our research is try and look for the simplest possible model that will capture what you need to capture to solve a problem. And that, I think, is what we may have done here. So actually, there's two models that we've used. The models are relating the hazard rate, and these two models that are at the top are very similar. So we're relating the hazard rate, which is the probability of the counterparty defaulting conditional on the fact that it hasn't defaulted already. The hazard rate is a function of the value of the derivatives that we have outstanding with the counterparty. So we're just postulating a model relating the hazard rate to the value of the derivatives. And you see there's two parameters in the model. There's there's a B parameter, which is showing the sensitivity of the hazard rate. So if B is zero, then there's no sensitivity. And B can be positive or negative. Positive value of B indicates wrong way risk. A negative value of B indicates right way risk. And then there's AT. And what AT is a calibration parameter. So once you've chosen B, then it's just a little bit of numerical work to calculate the AT, because you know what the counterparty's hazard rates, actually unconditional hazard rates, are. So you've got to make these hazard rates conditional on WT, consistent with the unconditional hazard rates that you're able to get elsewhere. So basically, you specify a value for B, and then AT is calculated by the term structure of hazard rates that you know anyway. Now, what's the difference between those two models? Actually, very little difference in practice. But in the model on the left-hand side, the hazard rate, you know, WT becomes very large. The hazard rate increases exponentially, and we didn't like that too much. When the value of the derivatives, when WT increases, becomes very large in the right-hand model, the hazard rate increases linearly, which is much more reasonable. So we tend to use the model on the right-hand side, and this is what it looks like. So you can see the hazard rate as a function of the value of the derivatives that you have outstanding. Left-hand side is the right-way risk, right-hand side is wrong-way risk. Estimating B, there's actually two ways of estimating B. One is the sort of subjective approach, where you ask the the account manager, who knows most about the company that we're dealing with, to make the estimate, and I've indicated the sort of question that the account manager might want to consider there. The other way of estimating B is to say, we have a portfolio of derivatives with the counterparty. Let's just invent some historical data. In other words, let's ask what the value of that portfolio of derivatives would have been in the past, given obviously a certain amount of work involved here. But given the values of market variables in the past, what would the value of the derivatives we have with the counterparty have been in the past? And then we also look at what the credit spread of the counterparty was in the past, and we can see what the relationship was. So we can estimate this, from historical data, or subjectively. And Alan and I have talked to a number of different dealers about this, and some seem to think the subjective approach is, whether they like our model or not, the subjective approach is better for wrong way risk, and others not. So this is just the math to do the calibration to get the AT, so I'm not going to spend time on that. So that's the model. Let me show you some results from using the model. First of all, we looked at let's suppose I have this is just to get a sense of how it all works. Let's suppose I just have a single long or short forward contract on a foreign exchange rate with you. So just one derivative in our portfolio. How does all this work? And what's interesting about this is that the results are actually somewhat counterintuitive. And what I mean by this is that if you had to guess what the impact of wrong-way risk or right-way risk was on CVA, you would guess wrongly in some situations. So what we've got at the top there is what the CVA was for B equals zero, which is no wrong-way risk. And then we look at the impact of B equals 0.03 per million dollars, those are the units of B, on CVA. And the interesting thing is the delta with respect to the exchange rate and the gamma with respect to the exchange rate. So what we've, we're looking at deltas and gammas, and delta with respect to the spread and gamma with respect to the spread. And across the top, we've got, I should explain, the first column is no collateral. The second column is there's collateral with a threshold of 10 and a cure period of 15 days. Then there's a collateral with a threshold of zero, that's capital K, and a cure period of 15 days. And then there's K equals minus 5, which means there's an independent amount of 5 million, and the cure period is, again, 15 days. And you can see that, one of the interesting, this is very reminiscent of some of the strange Greek letters you get for barrier options, that, the delta, here the gamma with respect to the exchange rate changes sign as we look at different cases. The delta moves around quite a bit. And here, actually, the delta and the gamma change sign when we look at a short position. So, that little test sort of convinced us that there were some interesting, non-intuitive results there. I won't go into all of them. Further tests, we generated portfolios of derivatives randomly to test the impact of a non-zero B on CVA. Different thresholds, different cure periods. What we did was we randomly generated 250 portfolios consisting of 25 option positions, long or short, in calls or puts on 5 different assets. So you've got 5 different assets, longs, calls and puts, you've got strike prices and times to maturity and so on to choose. So all of those parameters of the options were chosen randomly. So whether it was a call or a put, whether we're long or short, which of the 5 assets the option is on, the time to maturity. The strike price was always within 30% of the asset price, and the time to maturity was between 0 and 5 years. So, in other words, we're just generating some random portfolios just to see how everything works out. And we've actually done a lot of this experimentation. We've done experimentation involving interest rate derivatives as well. It's more complicated, and the results are very similar. So here's the situation when there's no collateral. So what we're plotting here is, this is on the horizontal axis, we've got the CVA calculated in the usual way with no wrong-way risk. And on the vertical axis, the change, not the percentage change, the absolute change in the CVA when there's wrong-way risk. And actually, you can see it's kind of linear. I mean, it varies depending on upon the sort of type of portfolio you've got. But basically, what this is showing, when there's no collateral, if there's a big CVA, then the impact of wrong-way risk tends to be big. If there's a small CVA, the impact of wrong-way risk tends to be small. And, given time constraints, there's, lots I could say to give you the intuition behind that, but this was a more interesting one. This is where the threshold is 10. Not uncommon to have thresholds in these CSAs. And the cure period is 15 days. The impact of wrong-way risk then is sort of upside-down U-shaped. It sort of increases and then decreases. The point here is that when there's a threshold, I mean, let's ignore the cure period for a moment. Let's suppose we didn't have that cure period of 15 days, which is a sort of second-order effect in this example. threshold of 10. What the threshold of 10 means that the exposure can never be greater than 10. Okay, because you start requiring collateral after 10, ignoring the cure period. So therefore, if you have a really big CVA, which will be 10, that means that the WTs are always greater than 10. Okay, so you know there's very little chance of the WTs being less than 10, in which case the impact of wrong way risk is negligible, because it doesn't matter whether the guy becomes more likely or less likely to default as WT increases or decreases, because the exposure is always 10, you know, in those extreme situations. So what we're talking about here is the situation where we're way out here somewhere, and it's almost certain that, you know, we're almost certain to sort of be above the threshold. And then there's a couple of other cases which I haven't got time to talk about too much, but this is the threshold is zero. It's a more linear relationship, and this is where there's an independent amount of five. In these two cases, the the cure period is what is the critical thing, and it's the volatility of the value of the portfolio during the cure period that drives the results. And if you look at the scales, the actual values of the CVAs and the change in the CVAs is a lot less for these. So these are the 250 samples. Conclusions. Simple model for incorporating wrong way and right way risk into CVA calculations. It's, as far as we can tell, the simplest model that's been proposed out there. It requires a single estimate of the sensitivity of the credit spread to the portfolio value, and I mentioned two different ways you could go about getting that. What we find is that wrong way risk has a pronounced effect on the CVA Greeks as well as on the CVA itself, and you know, it's, you know, it can be important to take that into account. And it also depends on whether there's a CSA or not a CSA. Okay, so I don't know, time for one or two questions.
You talked about in Basel II sort of 40% scale up on the CVA for wrong way risk. And if you look at your slide, probably the one that is independent now, it looks like that 40% is a conservative number, but it is kind of the top envelope of the point.
I hadn't really thought about the results from that point of view, but I'll take your word for it. But it's
not so much that one, but if we go back to there.
Yeah, this one, for example. Yeah, well, let's take no collateral, for example. So we'd be talking about the CVA being one here, and maybe going up, you know, by 30%, or you know, could be more. You know, it's yeah, it's around 40%. That's right. I mean, this all depends on the B parameter you use, of course, and we obviously chose a relatively high B parameter because we wanted to get a sense of what the relationship was. We, you know, it's not so. What I mean, what the Basel II regulations are saying is, across all your counterparties, some will have wrong way risk, some will have right way risk. You know, increasing by 40% sounds reasonable. Okay, now here we're just looking at the wrong way risk situations, and we're looking at probably relatively significant wrong way risk situations. So I'm not, yeah, but it's an interesting point. We hadn't really thought about doing that comparison. Oh, heaven forbid, if I was an accountant. Well, this Financial Times article, actually, which I would, you know, I think it was about Tuesday this week, something like that. I would urge you to get hold of it if you really want to read an amusing article about DVA. It made the point that 80% of the profits my reading of the article was it was saying 80% of the profits, third quarter profits of major U.S. banks was from DVA. Then it went on to say, well, you know, it's fairy tale accounting. Imagine you tried to apply that to your personal life. So you go along to your bank and say, well, you know, I'm borrowing this money from you, but actually my creditworthiness has gone through the floor. So actually, you know, we should change the terms of the loan because, you know, these loans are now obviously worth less to you and more to me. And they said, you know, good luck. if you try that, my view is that DVA is that it would have been better if accountants hadn't gone down this route because, yeah, in theory, incidentally, the IRS has had a big role in this because there's a big lawsuit between the IRS and Bank One in the U.S. which was a trial lawsuit where basically what the IRS wanted to Bank One to do was to add DVA to the value of its derivatives portfolio because that would increase its profitability, which would increase the tax it pays to the IRS. And you know how it is. It's really difficult to say who won that case in the end. I think, you know, because it just went on and on for years and years, but I think, you know, basically the IRS won it in the end. And I think the IRS may have had a big influence on the accounting authorities because that was well before the accounting standards wanted to do this. But the real problem with DVA is there's no way you can monetize it. You know, if my DVA has gone up by $3 billion, that's great. Where's the $3 billion? You know, there is no transaction I can enter into to monetize that $3 billion. Okay. As far as CVA is concerned, because I can't buy and sell credit derivatives on myself. That, you know, nobody's going to trade with me on that. And that would be the only way I could monetize DVA. CVA, I could, I can monetize CVA loss because I can enter into credit derivatives to offset it. So, I don't know. I think if I was able to dictate accounting rules, I would have steered clear from DVA. It seems to cause more problems. And you know, you talk to anybody in the industry, they don't agree with it. Particularly European. And European financial institutions tend to be a little bit behind U.S. financial institutions in terms of accepting DVA. Yeah?
Perhaps DVA makes sense when you have your two big sales.
Yeah? Maybe. I'll think about that one. Yeah. If you really are too big to fail, DVA is zero.
Thank you very much.